Welcome to the Women Who Fights podcast. We empower female fighters to take full agency over their training. Our goal is to celebrate and inspire others with the incredible action women and allies are taking to level the playing field. We talk to experts, uncover prejudice, and champion what's driving our progress.
And today we have Georgia with us. Georgia is on a mission to spread the wisdom of conscious combat coaching around the world to make martial arts accessible to all trauma survivors. Georgia runs online and in-person trauma-informed kickboxing programs and works with martial artists to help them develop trauma-informed curriculum in their chosen style. Thank you for being with us today. Could you start by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything about myself is related to fighting. My hobbies, my work, my degree, everything. I am now almost more of a jack of all trades. I have a black belt in karate. I have a blue belt in jiu-jitsu. I do kickboxing, Muay Thai. I've had pro fights. So I've kind of dabbled in everything that has anything to do with combat sports. It's what I watch. It's what I do as a hobby. It's what I do for work. It's basically everything that I love doing. Outside of that, I do also play the saxophone. I love being in nature. I love cooking. I have my own podcast, which I love hosting and talking to other women about their incredible stories of survivorship in martial arts. And yeah, I'm really excited to be here. I am super passionate about this space and helping more women be able to occupy space in the fighting world.
Wow. And you train Muay Thai. Can you tell us how did you start? Because kickboxing is, you do kickboxing informed coach, trauma informed coaching. So can you talk to us about how you began that journey?
Yeah, so I started karate first. My mum did karate and she stopped when she had me and she went back to it when I was about 12. And I saw her training and I was like, I want to do that. Like at the time I was really involved with dancing and I was like, I want to do that. And she said, you have to wait till you're 13 and then you can train with the adults. Because I don't want you getting like the bad habits of being in the kids class. My mom's quite tough. And so I started training with her. It was like she and I and not that many other girls and kind of like a group of men doing a type of karate called Kyokushin karate. And of course, there are many styles of karate, but essentially what you need to know about Kyokushin is it's very full contact. It's bare knuckle, there's no face punching, but it's not a light touch style of karate at all. So that was kind of how I was raised in martial arts. And then I moved cities to Melbourne from where I'm from, which is a kind of a smaller town outside of the city. And I was like, I don't have a family anymore. Like I don't have a gym, I don't have karate. I need to start doing martial arts somewhere. So I joined what is one of the biggest MMA gyms in the city, Absolute MMA. And I tried everything. And the thing that I was best at immediately was Muay Thai because it was most like karate. So of course my ego was like, this is the one that I'm going to stick with. And I got hooked. Like I went from doing karate to doing Muay Thai every day. Then I was sparring. And at that point I had said, I'm done competing in karate. I just want to do it for fun. But as many fighters will know, it doesn't always work out that way. It's quite addictive. So I was sparring and then I was training in Thailand and then I was taking a Muay Thai fight, which is Muay Thai without elbows. So you can clinch, but yeah, you can't hit with your elbows. And then I won a couple of Muay Thai fights and my coach said, do you want to fight with elbows? I was like, of course I want to fight with elbows. And then, you know, before you know it, you're doing all these full-on Muay Thai fights. And so it escalates. I always say that to people, especially I always say that to my clients. You know, it escalated. It didn't start from zero to, you know, elbowing people in the face, but there is a gradual build-up to get towards that point, although it did escalate quite quickly for me because I did get really quite obsessed with it. So, yeah, that's how I got started in Muay Thai.
Amazing. And then when did you start doing jiu-jitsu?
So jiu-jitsu, I started about 3-4 years ago. My jiu-jitsu journey was quite staggered because I would go through phases of finishing a Muay Thai fight, saying, all right, I want to do something just for fun. When you go through a fight camp, I always find at the end, I'm so tired of being really disciplined with the diet and the training and everything that goes with it that I just want to do something for fun. So I kept starting jiu-jitsu off and on for a while, but then I would take another fight and not have the space for it. And then I got to a point in Muay Thai where the weight cutting started to get really tough for me, physically, but more so emotionally. And I had a lot of trouble with body dysmorphia. So I decided to distance myself from training in Muay Thai because I knew that the temptation for me to continue disordered eating and weight cutting was too high. But I needed a martial art. Like I said, I'm obsessed with training and I find it really difficult to take more than a couple of days off. So I really got stuck into doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which was an easy transition because my partner trains. And so we went to Bali and I was going to do Muay Thai. But when I got there, I was like, I'm just going to go full on into doing Jiu-Jitsu. So I did 2 months of training, like twice a day, full-time training. And I got, again, obsessed with training in Jiu-Jitsu. And then we trained together over all of COVID because the lockdowns here were super restrictive. So we had more than a year in total of time where we couldn't physically go into a gym. So I was training at home a lot and, you know, watching instructionals and things like that. And now that we're back, I've also got hooked on that. And that's more taken all my focus now is in training. And I recently got my blue belt and started competing at blue belt, which sucked, but I'm excited to get better at. And yeah.
Amazing. And yeah, because me and Marina train in jiu-jitsu, so that's our like our background.
So you spoke a little bit about body dysmorphia. Can you tell us a little bit more about it? What exactly went on there? And because for you to be like, I'm not gonna compete because this is taking a toll, it means that it was intense. So what exactly did you feel? If you don't mind me asking.
Of course. And I'm super open about this. So there was a couple of things that were really significant for me related to the weight cutting. So one was called amenorrhea, which is the absence of a period. And what I find is that within a lot of combat sports, and I found this in jiu-jitsu and Muay Thai, it's really common for it to either not be spoken about or for women to say, oh, but it's normal, because doctors will tell you that it's normal. And doctors told me that it was normal for years because I was an athlete, where essentially some combination of overtraining, under eating, and having too low a body fat percentage will cause your hormones to shut down. And that had a lot of flow-on effects for me in terms of my mood, in terms of my gut health, how I felt. And it reached a point where I hadn't put two and two together for a long time. And all of a sudden I was like, oh my God. And also with help from loved ones was significant in this, where I started to realize that it was quite unhealthy for me to be sustaining this weight. And keep in mind, I was fighting in a weight class that was, I think now relative to my weight, probably two classes lower than where I should be fighting for my height. And it's really common to see that in combat sports, that people will try and get the, especially in Muay Thai, the reach advantage is much more advantageous than jiu-jitsu, for example. They'll try and get the maximum, you know, squeeze out of the benefit from being a bigger person in a smaller weight class. And really, my self-esteem was such at that point where I thought I needed that in order to be an effective fighter. But also, I was very attached to the idea of what I saw being what a fighter should look like. And that was very thin, you know, like very defined in terms of abs and like muscle definition. And that comes from having a really low body fat percentage. And so much of my identity was tied to being a fighter. But I used that as a way to justify not eating or only eating secretly by myself. So what you would call like binging and then restricting. Obsessing over calories. So, you know, I couldn't look at to this day any meal and I can tell you pretty close carbs, proteins and fats and like how many calories or kilojoules are going to be in it. And I got to a point where I wasn't eating food. I was just looking at numbers, and I was so disconnected from all of the beautiful things that food gives us for culture and for connection to people and enjoyment, that it was really impacting my mental health. So I needed to take that step back from that to rebuild my body. And I, when I went to Bali, I was like, all right, I'm going to eat rice. Like, I was not eating any carbs at all, which is really, really bad for fighters. And a lot of fighters do it. I was like, okay, I'm going to eat, you know, like some desserts if I want to. I'm just going to eat until my metabolism resets itself, my body heals itself, and see where we land. And it was really difficult. I had a really hard time accepting my body at first. And honestly, it's an off, like it's an ongoing kind of process, that body acceptance. And I'm not 100% there yet. But I think for my clients now, given that I work in this trauma-informed space, that's my motivation to stay here. Because I need to set an example for my clients. Eating disorders often arise from trauma, and body disconnection is very common in trauma. And so I feel that now I need to be a leader in that space. And that's really good motivation for me too, because it's very tempting, honestly, to go back to being really, really skinny.
Love how open you are.
Can you talk to us about the Fight Back Project and your trauma-informed coaching?
Yeah, so the Fight Back Project started when I was working in a physiotherapy clinic as an exercise scientist. And I had a client who was a trauma psychologist. And I was talking to him about kickboxing, because, of course, you talk about yourself with your clients, and what else would I talk about? And he said, oh, have you ever thought about teaching kickboxing to trauma survivors? And I had studied exercise science because I wanted to do something with my passion, right? I wanted to work in fighting. I really quickly realized that I wasn't interested in making athletes better at sport. I don't really care about making people 2% faster or stronger. And the work that goes into strength training and strength and conditioning kind of work, you've got to be really passionate about it to want to work with athletes. And I just wasn't, even with fighting athletes. I only really enjoyed making myself a better athlete. But that side of things, I didn't care about working with clients. And when he said that, it was like this huge light bulb went off. I was like, I could combine my expertise in exercise science with the martial arts, with making a meaningful difference in somebody's life. Tell me more about what this would look like. And he recommended a book, which I recommend to everybody, which is called The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk. It's a really, really great read. It's got a lot of neuroscience, but it's layered in with stories, so it's really easy to read. And I read it, understood a little bit more about trauma and trauma therapy. So the book talks about yoga and acting, and it even alludes to martial arts a little bit, although at the point of writing, there hadn't been any formal trauma-informed martial arts programs. And I was like, okay, this is amazing. Yes, let's do this. I want to do it, but I don't really know where to start. And that was the thing, was I was thinking, I'm going to need to rent a space. I'm going to have to raise all this capital to start this program. And I couldn't imagine doing it while I was working full-time and competing like as a full-time athlete. So I paused the idea, and I kind of forgot about it for about 6 months, a little bit longer, which is when COVID happened. And in Australia, it was kind of like nationwide stand downs before government assistance came in. They fired basically everyone in my industry in exercise because gyms all closed. So I had no job, and I was like, what am I going to do with my life at this point? And it was at the same time that everyone was moving exercise online because no one had a choice. Everyone had to stay home. And so I was like, I could do trauma-informed kickboxing. Actually, I didn't even know the word trauma-informed existed at that point. I was like, I could do kickboxing with trauma survivors online. So I called up a couple of the psychologists that I knew from my work and who I had worked with in an exercise capacity. And I said, remember that crazy idea? Should we bring it back but do it online? And luckily for me, the psychs that I spoke to were really supportive, and they were like, yes, you should totally do it. Write an outline for a program, and then we'll talk about what would be different. And so we did a back and forth for a little bit with me writing ideas and researching and them saying, okay, change this, change that. They brought in some more somatic experiencing specific psychologists, which are psychologists that work with the body rather than with the thoughts and emotions to process trauma primarily. And so if we looked from a somatic experiencing perspective, how would we apply that theory to the program that you're running? And we came up with a pilot, which we ran with four women online, because online was a thing. And it went really, really well. And so I ran a couple more programs and a couple more programs. Then we reopened. So we started to be able to do in-person locally. There's still the demand for online. And that's kind of how the program has, I almost want to say, organically grown. Of course, there was a lot of work that went into it and it's been, you know, tweaked and gone back to different people along the way. It's also been a lot impacted by the podcast that I ran, which I ran concurrently with starting the program at the time where I was like, this is what I'm going to do. I also decided, and I'm going to start a podcast about it. Because to be honest, I didn't think anyone would refer patients to me because I'm not a psychologist and this wasn't a proven program. So I was really, really lucky to get trust from the clients that I worked with and the psychologists who referred them. But I didn't imagine that it was going to happen quickly. I thought it was going to be a slow thing. So I wanted to take some sort of action in the space. So I started the podcast. It just happened that the program kind of took off at the same time. But luckily for me, through the podcast, I was able to interview a lot of researchers in the martial arts space and also in the psychology space and survivors. And then my podcast kind of became like my research project that was fueling improvements to the program, and they really were just such a beautiful marriage, because I would also get insights from running the program that I could then share as part of the podcast, and the podcast would inform the program. So that's essentially how the Fight Back Project has started and grown.
Wow, it's so like it was meant to happen then. Can you tell us a little bit about what is the importance of being trauma-informed as a coach?
So specific to the field of martial arts, we have actually data now that just came out of Australia that shows that many, many women, in fact, the majority of women who start martial arts do so on the basis that they have experienced some sort of a trauma. Sometimes that comes from feeling like they want to learn to defend themselves. Sometimes that comes from wanting to increase their confidence and other reasons. And so it's really important for all martial arts coaches to recognize that we want to do less harm. As in, we don't want to ever re-traumatize someone when they have made a personal decision to say, okay, the thing that I feel like I need for my healing is to go and, you know, train in XYZ martial art. And then they come and they're like, let's say, immediately thrown into sparring. Or there's comments that are made that make them feel really uncomfortable. Or the level that they're expected to perform to straight away, maybe like complicated combinations whereby trauma impacts your ability to learn and to remember new information, and they feel overwhelmed. And then they decide, actually, it wasn't the right decision. I shouldn't have listened to my body. I should just be in therapy. That's the absolute last thing that we would ever want, because our therapy or psychology systems are all overwhelmed at the moment. And it's imperative that people are able to use their body wisdom to do what's aligned for them. Martial arts aren't going to be for everybody, but for the people who do reach out and say, this is what I feel like I need, I think it's super important that coaches are at least trauma aware, if not trauma informed, so that they can make sure that they retain those students who are really the people who need to learn how to fight the most in our society.
Amazing. So can I just clarify, is your trauma-informed coaching is for students or is it for coaches?
So I work with both. So I teach women. So I work specifically with female-identified persons, both online and in person. to do kickboxing classes. I do some one-on-one work. It kind of depends on the situation, but I really do encourage for working towards the group classes because I think it's so beautiful to heal as part of a community. And then I also work separately to that with other martial arts coaches across all martial arts. I have clients who are in jiu-jitsu, in karate, boxing, kickboxing, to help them develop trauma-informed programs that are aligned to their specific type of martial art. So, of course, there's a big difference between jiu-jitsu and kickboxing, for example, but also aligned to their personal values and their skill sets as a coach and a human. So, you know, what works for me is in part due to, you know, the kind of personality that I have. And so we look at, you know, well, what are their strengths as a coach and what are the strengths of their martial art and what can we draw upon using trauma-informed principles to create a program.
Okay, amazing. And so in what ways can you give us an insight into some of the tools you'd give the coaches to be have that trauma-informed awareness?
Yeah, so to start at awareness is a really good place. So firstly, understanding what is trauma. And there's a quote from Gabor Mate, who's one of the world leaders in trauma, which, to paraphrase, is essentially, trauma is not what happens to you, but it is how your nervous system responds to what happens to you. So the first thing that I try to work with coaches to understand is that we don't want to overdiagnose and symptomize people. And that means not say, oh, they have PTSD, they're broken, but to understand that the way that nervous systems respond to trauma is completely reasonable and normal given the circumstances. And also, thank goodness that the nervous system has responded in that way for that person, because that's what protected them at the time of their trauma. So we have that as a fundamental understanding, that everyone is doing the best that they can given the situations that they've been in. And then we learn to recognize some of the common impacts that trauma will have upon the nervous system. So that is primarily to preface someone towards either fight or flight responses. So to hyperarousal is what we call. And so those are things like noticing if clients you work with get really agitated, really angry, they've clenched fists, clenched jaws, they kind of look like they want to fight a lot of the time, and recognizing that as not being someone with anger issues, but somebody whose body is, again, doing the best they can with trauma. Or somebody who seems very skittish and flighty, someone who is quick to run out of a class, or maybe they just seem like they want to run out of a class, they're quite distant, they're fidgety all the time, so it's a flight response. Also noticing if somebody is dissociated or disconnected from their body or in shutdown mode. So recognizing when people might be either limp or have distant eyes or not be present in their body in some way, which is super, super common and not spoken about enough, how frequently people appear to be in a martial arts class but are actually either watching themselves from above in a third person perspective or just completely blacked out and have absolutely zero memory of the event. So noticing how to look at people, and really, if you oversimplify it, looking at your students and noticing, does anyone seem really angry? Does anyone seem really scared? Or does anyone seem really distant? And making sure that we help them return to their window of tolerance, which we'll probably come back to in a little bit. But that's the start of being trauma aware, is being able to recognize first the signs of trauma and then being able to help students ground themselves. So I always start with coaches to develop 1 to 3 really easy to remember for them grounding strategies that do not involve breath work. And the reason for that is that breath work is a wonderful tool for a lot of people, but for a lot of other people, breathing causes them to focus on their fight or flight response as they breathe in and can be overwhelming. And so strategies like the 5-4-3-2-1, engaging senses like sight, smell, hearing, etc., or feeling connection to the floor, feet on the floor, body scans, those are generally safer grounding strategies than going to, all right, let's breathe. So having those and picking just a few that are your go-to kind of tools as a coach that you can immediately pull out in the event of seeing a client who is outside their window of tolerance, who is feeling overwhelmed, to help them ground themselves is the perfect baseline. If you just know that, everything else you do is going to be so much more effective. Your students are going to be able to learn better. They're going to be able to retain the information. They're going to enjoy the class more. It's going to get you, you know, a large portion of the way there. Then I will work with coaches to help them apply trauma-informed principles. So in developing their program, how can they create a sense of safety? How can they build trust? What do they need to do in order to be transparent about their scope of practice as a martial artist, as opposed to a psychologist or therapist, for example? How can you create peer support within a program? So how can you have survivors sharing stories with each other in a way that is safe? How can you integrate choice into the program by using things like invitational language, by honoring clients' right to say no to things, to opt in, opt out? How can you create a strengths-based model? So how can we focus on what clients do well as opposed to what they need to improve upon? And how do we be sensitive to things like gender? For example, is it a female-identified program? And also cultural and historical differences and histories that may have led or been part of their trauma. So in a nutshell, that's kind of what I work with clients to develop, is how to apply all of those principles and have a good baseline understanding of trauma. We also integrate the therapeutic elements of their martial art, so the inherently therapeutic elements of their martial art, which a lot draws upon a big research piece that I conducted, but also their personal insights about what they've found to be therapeutic about their own martial art, so that we can leverage the strengths of that. And then we also do step-by-step lesson planning. So how to do a warm-up, how to create, you know, the activities that you're going to include in the session, how to do a cool down, how to run an initial consultation, how many students are you going to have, how long is your course going to run for, where are you going to teach it, basically all the logistical things, so that they don't get to the end and go, okay, I've got a really good understanding, but now what do I do?
Georgia, sorry, would so that I know if I understood correctly, for just trauma survivors, or are we talking about a class that's mixed with some people that are trauma survivors?
So in the context of me teaching coaches, those are classes, cohorts, of martial arts coaches that I'm working with. In terms of the work that I do, so like the clients that I apply all of those principles with when I'm working with them, those are small classes, and I work with the maximum of 6 women at a time, right, for kickboxing, both online and in person.
Right. Okay, I get it. And you talked a little bit about the window of tolerance. Can you tell us what that is and how it works in trauma?
So the window of tolerance can be thought of like your capacity for resilience. So if you think about a window and you imagine on either side of it, the states that we spoke about the hyperarousal, so fight or flight, and the hypoarousal, so freeze. Everybody has a window of tolerance, but the width of it is going to depend on your past experiences. So generally speaking, we're inside our window of tolerance. And when we're within our window of tolerance, that's when we're able to do things like critical thinking, comparison, and social engagement. So that's when I can look at you, I can read your body language, and I can respond accordingly. Makes being a human sound kind of robotic, but for the context, in the context of the explanation, it's necessary. So we typically will be somewhere within our window of tolerance most of the time. And that's really important, because that's the time where we can learn. And that's also the time where we can relate to other people and notice things in our environment. And if you think about that in the context of competition and fighting, it's really, really important that we're in our window of tolerance. Otherwise, we're going to do things that are muscle memory. And that can be good or it can be bad. And sometimes that will mean that we make mistakes that end up meaning we get submitted early or we get knocked out, for example. So whether or not you're in your window of tolerance is going to depend a lot upon external stimuli and your experience of those external stimuli. So for example, say I'm inside my window of tolerance and then somebody says something really, really mean to me and I take it really, really personally. That might make me want to fight that person and push me outside my window of tolerance. But say I have a really, really wide window of tolerance. If somebody says that same thing to me, it might push me towards the edge of my window of tolerance, but I can still notice that, use my social engagement system to tell them why I didn't think it was appropriate for them to speak to me in that way, rather than having a body reaction. And there are like infinite kind of examples of times where you could get pushed out of your window of tolerance. And for trauma survivors, other things that will push them outside their window of tolerance will be things like smells or sights in their environment that might remind them of their initial trauma. It could be, you know, an additional sensitivity to criticism. It could be praise. It could be the fact also that when we're sleep deprived, our window is going to shrink as well too. So if you think about the window itself, imagine that the window of tolerance of a trauma survivor is going to be smaller. And so it's easier for them to be triggered. It's easier for them to be overwhelmed and to be stuck in fight or flight or freeze mode. And that's why it's so important to know grounding strategies and how to bring yourself back into your window of tolerance, but also to help somebody else come back into their window of tolerance, because that's the state where learning takes place. It's really difficult to learn without being able to use your analytical thinking neocortex, or your more new part of your brain. If you think about, okay, well, if you have a small window of tolerance, how can I make it bigger? And everybody should want a bigger window of tolerance. You can't really have too big of a window of tolerance. So the way that you grow your window of tolerance is firstly to have an awareness of where in your body changes as you move out of your window of tolerance. So for example, I feel a knot in my stomach and a lump in my throat. And if I notice those physical sensations, sometimes I'll notice them before I have acted, before I have also added thoughts that will rationalize why I'm behaving the way that I'm behaving. And this is called bottom-up processing, and it's juxtaposed to top-down processing. So there's a lot of information for everybody, but essentially, sometimes in life, you will have a thought, and that will be prompted by, say, somebody hurling an insult at you. That will follow by you feeling an emotion, say anger. Then you will feel that anger somewhere in your body. This is top-down processing. Bottom-up processing is the opposite. Sometimes you just feel really anxious, and a lot of women can probably relate to, for example, when you're on your bleed and you feel angry or emotional and you're not even sure why. Oftentimes what we'll do is we'll go, there's a feeling in my body. What is it? It's anxiety. Why am I feeling anxiety? It must be because da 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 da. This person did this to me. I'm stressed out about work. Sometimes that's true, but a lot of the time we've just added narrative where it wasn't necessary. And so the practice of being able to feel body sensations means sometimes you can put a pause in between the sensation and labeling it with the emotion and the thought. And in doing so, every time you do that, you disrupt that bottom-up process, you expand your window of tolerance because you have more of an awareness, kind of like a third perspective awareness of what's happening to you, and you can choose accordingly. And the other way that you expand your window of tolerance is to spend time towards the edge, but not outside the window. So towards the edge of your comfort zone, but not to the point where you've gone into a fight or flight or a freeze response. Every time you go outside your window of tolerance, your nervous system is plastic. So due to neuroplasticity, you will reinforce that neural pathway and you will continue to shrink your window of tolerance. Your brain goes, oh, okay, what we need to do is keep relying upon these responses because they are what's safe. Conversely, if you go towards the edge, but you stay in your social engagement, you stay in your window of tolerance, your brain goes, I was sufficient for us to stay inside the window of tolerance. And so that neural pathway gets strengthened. And so your window of tolerance gets wider. So by practicing listening to your body and by challenging yourself, but not quite too much, you can expand your capacity for resilience. You can expand your window of tolerance. And therefore you can move through the world less overwhelmed and upset and triggered by all of the external stimuli that are constantly coming towards you. And what I find for a lot of clients is that learning about the window of tolerance as language and kind of personalizing it, or depersonalizing it, so saying, no, I can't do that, it will affect my window of tolerance. So knowing and putting in place boundaries to say, I need to, you know, do grounding before I can meet with this certain person because I know they affect my window of tolerance, or I know before I start jits that I need to spend some time because I know it's likely to push me out of my window of tolerance, or I notice that when I get mounted that pushes me outside my window of tolerance, and I can have an awareness of that and I can say to someone, it affects my window of tolerance. And for a lot of people, that's really, it's wonderful for a couple of reasons. One is because it creates an external kind of thing to not blame, but reason to be able to say it's because of my window of tolerance. And when you're in a group setting where that's common language, it's really, really wonderful. It's super easy for clients to say, I can't do that because of my window of tolerance. But also it takes away the self-blame from saying, how come that person can, you know, experience the same things as me and they don't get so overwhelmed? Like, why do I get so overwhelmed? It's because it's super normal to have a small window of tolerance if you've experienced trauma.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Why is that it's normal is that because your body has just got a few things that work and it's just like, right, we know that these things work. We're not going to allow for the growth of it because it's dangerous.
Sort of. So there's a theory put forward by Stephen Porges, which is called the polyvagal theory, which says that most of the time where we use our social engagement system, and you can also think of these as lines of defense. So the first line of defense is social engagement system. Well, the example I often use is, say you're at home alone and you hear a noise and then somebody comes into the room with a knife. Someone breaks into your house. Okay. So trigger warning, if thinking about these things makes you feel overwhelmed, please take some space for yourself. So if someone comes into the room with a knife, the first line of defense for your nervous system is to say, hey, don't you come in here because my boyfriend's going to be home any minute now and he's got a gun, for example. Okay, that would be social engagement system. Now I'm going to map these out as if it's a step by step by step thing, but this is all milliseconds apart. So your brain will go, is it viable for me to use my social engagement system? Yes or no? In that situation, most people are probably not going to use their social engagement system. Their reptilian brain, which is the part of their brain that acts automatically, and thank goodness, because it's much quicker at sending out our action signals to our body than our analytical newer brain, which likes to process information slowly and make the best decision possible. Sometimes that's not an option in a situation like this, which could be life or death. So you'll bypass that system and go to the next line, which is fight or flight. Your brain will quickly analyze, is it possible for me to run? Nope, they're standing in front of the door. Is it possible for me to fight? Well, they've got a knife and I don't have a weapon. So even though I train in a martial art, maybe it's not. And so the next thing that the brain will default to is freeze. And so it will go into shutdown. And the reason for this is thought to be because shutdown is often accompanied by dissociation, which means that you don't feel pain, that it's an animal response, kind of akin to playing dead. So if I slump and, you know, be disconnected, then maybe the person will get bored and then walk away. And we have no control over this freeze response. And in fact, it's the most common response in response to trauma. And so what happens is that sometimes it's that your brain wanted to fight back. So say sometimes you've been held down and that's the reason why you couldn't, or in the context of you making a decision that it's not possible. In either way, your nervous system gets really activated by trauma and then can't complete an action. And that essentially leads to an action being stuck in the body. Because it is such a, there is such huge stakes with these kind of decisions, what happens is that your brain is supercharged into neuroplasticity. So your brain, if you're a kid, this is even higher, but even for adults, the urgency of a life or death situation like this will mean, the perceived urgency, I should say, is the most important thing. The perceived urgency of this situation means that your brain goes, okay, in future we need to make the decision to freeze quicker because that was what saved us, and so now we have learned that as a learned response. And so the window shrinks because you bypass the social engagement system quicker to go to what is deemed the more viable self-protection response. And with chronic trauma, for example, in domestic violence and family violence, where you're in a state of constant hypervigilance looking out for where the next danger is going to be, you almost never will use your social engagement system. You will always default to fight or flight or freeze, and also fawn. So fawn is akin to, it's used at the same level as freeze, and fawn is going along with whatever the attacker wants and people pleasing type of behaviors, which are also survival responses. So the brain learns that those are the most viable options. Social engagement system, being in the window of tolerance, just hasn't worked for me, hasn't saved me, so I'm not going to use it.
All right, and how can martial arts or kickboxing help broaden that tolerance?
So we spoke about two things that you can do to broaden your window of tolerance are to spend time towards the outside of your window of tolerance, but not outside it. And martial arts does that for a lot of people, right? It's this kind of a scary thing. It's a new thing. So you're proving to yourself that you can do it, but also you're spending time towards the outside of your window of tolerance. There's also experiential confidence that comes from learning to fight. So, for example, in Krav Maga, they call this invisible self-defense. Invisible self-defense is the fact that you hold yourself differently and more confidently because you know that you have experience with fighting and you feel some confidence in that. What that does is that changes your perception of yourself as being, for one, somebody who is worth defending and someone who can defend themselves, and that in of itself will grow the window of tolerance. Then there is the piece around interoception, which is the word we use for feeling what is happening inside your body. So when I spoke about how you feel the knot in your stomach or the lump in your throat, or, you know, different things for different people, that's me personally. That practice of feeling what's happening inside your body can be really greatly improved through learning martial arts. Think about jiu-jitsu. We're constantly aware of where are our limbs, where are the other person's limbs, and feeling that connection of body to body. In kickboxing, we're feeling how far am I away from that person? You know, what is my range? How hard am I hitting them? How hard are they hitting me? And we're titrating that in a way so that we're looking after each other. So am I hitting them too hard? Not hard enough? And this ongoing, what's called implicit and explicit consent around how hard we're training together will increase interoception. And then you can increase that almost exponentially by deliberately noticing that as a coach. So explicitly reminding clients to notice what is happening inside of their body will also expand the window of tolerance. And there are myriad of other reasons why martial arts are therapeutic and will have indirect response or indirect effects on the window of tolerance. So for instance, community. So you form a really, really strong community with a group of people and you feel connected in a way that people often haven't experienced anywhere else. And a lot of people talk about their martial arts family as opposed to like just the people that they train with. The increase in confidence from self-defense, but also from, you know, doing something for yourself. increasing positive moods. So, you know, feeling good after training, you get lots of dopamine from achieving goals, you get oxytocin from physical connection, you get serotonin from doing something that's enjoyable, and you get endorphins from the increased heart rate and physical activity aspect. There's meaning that comes from engaging with martial arts. So people find that they get purpose within their lives. And honestly, the list kind of goes on. For if you ask people, you know, what has been the impact of training martial arts upon your life? It is transformative. It is confidence boosting, community engaging. It's a great way to connect to your body for a lot of people. And I do always say it's not for everyone. Some people are going to prefer yoga. Some people are going to prefer acting, drama, art, different sports. That's totally cool. But for a lot of people, martial arts are really powerful. And I think a big part of that comes from the fact that as a sport, you can see how they have real life use. To me, there's not that much use in learning how to play cricket, for example, because it's kind of only useful for playing cricket. But, you know, to learn how to choke someone, that's useful in multiple contexts.
Can you talk to us a little bit about interoception? You've mentioned it, but can you define what that is?
Yeah, so if you think about, for example, when you're hungry, how do you know you're hungry? What does that feel like inside your body? And so we have lots of different receptors in our body and in our brain that feed us back all of that information. And they're not always in our consciousness at all times. They're always working though. So for example, because I'm recording this podcast and I'm concentrating on talking to both of you, I'm not really aware of the fact that I'm sitting in a chair or the fact that I haven't had breakfast yet, except for now that I've just said it and brought my awareness to it. And now I have noticed those things. So that's interoception. And we all innately have the ability to do that. However, trauma, for one thing, will cause body disconnection. So if you think about the freeze response and dissociation, that can also become learned. So we're not just numbing the pain. It's not possible to selectively numb, to say I only want to not feel the bad things. When the brain decides that numbing is necessary, all things get numbed. Feeling, connection to, you know, the chair that you're sitting on, feelings of hunger, you know, feelings of emotions and where you feel those in your body, including positive emotions, get lost. And that can mean things like you don't feel when you're hungry, so you don't eat, or you don't know what hungry feels like, so you overeat, or it can look like hurting yourself repeatedly while you're training because you don't feel that you're pushing yourself to a high intensity. You don't even know what the word intensity means. And I work with clients to help them, you know, first put a number to intensity and then to work out for themselves what intensity actually means. Because a lot of people have just absolutely no awareness of that and are frequently injuring themselves by pushing through because they don't realize what they're pushing through. They actually have no feeling of that. And beyond trauma, I think we have a lot of bodily disconnection in our society now because bodies are seen, particularly for women, as objects, you know, something to constantly improve upon for appearance reasons, but not something to love and to nurture and to live inside of. We are often exterocepting, so looking, our awareness is often outside in our external environment rather than noticing what's happening in our body due to technology. So, you know, we're in the world of social media or we're in the world of our phones or our computers and screens. And when we're doing that, that you're not concurrently noticing what's happening in my body. How do I feel about this? And in fact, that's a really powerful tool, is when you're scrolling, notice how does it feel in your body? Does it feel good or does it feel a little bit icky? And if it feels icky, that's a good time to say either I'm following the wrong people or I need to take a break from social media. And so interoception as a practice is a way that we can use listening to our bodies and our body's wisdoms to our advantage and for our betterment. And particularly women have a very, very strong innate body wisdom, this sense of if something does or doesn't feel right, that we often bypass because we're told that we shouldn't connect to our body, that our bodies are objects, they are things to change in appearance, to appease other people, and in response to marketing and commercials and things like that. And when you disregard that common advice and come home to your body and listen to your body, that's where a lot of healing can take place, both from trauma and also from the patriarchy, which oppresses absolutely all women.
Absolutely. I think there's, I have experience with that, reconnecting to your body and stopping and feeling. And it's amazing how disconnected you can become without being aware of it, without any trauma needed. It is, as you say, it's just our culture. Can you talk to us a little bit about why choice is so important for trauma-informed coaching and how coaches can give choice in that space?
Yes, so when we think about trauma, we think about the absolute absence of choice. No human being would ever choose something that they will experience as traumatic. So even if you think about events that might seem like adversity or painful or uncomfortable that some people would choose to engage in as part of what they like doing, that's not trauma if they've chosen it. So fundamentally, trauma is the absence of choice. So it's really important that we work with clients to help them realize that they do have choice in the world. And so there are a few ways that we can do that. One is through invitational language. And what I mean by that is prefacing invitations, or what you would normally think of as instructions within your martial arts class, with things like, if you like, when you're ready, you might like to, you could, and explaining to clients that you say these things genuinely, as in clients can opt out and say no at any point. And this goes against, I think, a lot of traditional martial arts coaching, where it's very much under the system of what we call senpai kohai, which means senior to junior. I'm the higher belt, I'm the higher grade, I'm the teacher, I say, therefore you do. And it's a really hierarchical structure. Dispelling that and saying, actually, you have a lot of wisdom and you know your body better than anyone, better than me, it doesn't matter that I'm a black belt. So I'm going to honor that wisdom by giving you choice and saying, you can opt out of this if you want. Also giving people options. So, all right, now we're going to do this, but if you want, you can do that instead. That will be specific to your kind of martial art. For example, we're going to practice roundhouse kicks. If you like, you can practice to the leg, you can do to the body, or you can do to the head. Depends what height is feeling comfortable for you today. And the other thing that we do is we make sure that when clients come to us with suggestions for things that they want to work on, we honor those. So for example, if a client says, today can we please work on roundhouse kicks, I really want to apply what I've been thinking about in terms of my hip movement and my rotation in this class, but it wasn't in your lesson plan, to be flexible enough to say, yes, we can totally integrate what you want to do into this class today, because it's as much yours as it is mine. And so we honor their choices by honoring when they say no, giving them options, and by respecting the things that clients come to us saying that they would like to integrate as part of their class.
And what other trauma-informed therapies are available out there apart from martial arts, and do they work with the same principle?
So trauma-sensitive yoga is probably the most well-known trauma-informed therapy, and so that was produced largely by Bessel van der Kolk, who wrote The Body Keeps the Score, the book I mentioned earlier, and also through the work of David Emerson and others, and is now really, really widely known and popular. There is also trauma-informed weightlifting, which also comes from the Justice Research Institute, which is where trauma-sensitive yoga comes from. I've done their online training program, and it does follow a lot of similar principles to trauma-informed martial arts, and as does trauma-sensitive yoga. And in fact, really the three pillars of trauma-sensitive yoga, from the way that I understand it, from having studied it, are interoception, choice, and being present. So this idea that you're not thinking about the past or the future while you're doing the activity. And from my mind, yoga's pretty good at that. But if anyone's done yoga, it's so slow that there's definitely times where you can think about other things. But martial arts, you're going to be really hard pressed in an hour of training, you know, especially while you're working with a partner. But even otherwise, the movements are so complicated, especially when they're new. And when they're not new, then you just make them more complicated by doing longer combinations or learning new techniques, etc. It's really hard to be thinking about something else. So it really does engage those flow states of being present. So those are the three pillars of how trauma-sensitive yoga works that 100% are also how trauma-informed martial arts work. And then you've also got art therapy, dance movement therapy, and drama therapy. So those are all more expressive. So creating dances that represent the emotions or the trauma that you feel and expressing that or moving it through your body by creating artwork through dance or painting or drawing how you're feeling about it or by acting how you felt about it. And so those I think are more similar to martial arts than yoga and weightlifting, because in martial arts we have a degree of creativity, right? You choose what move am I going to do, how am I going to pass the guard, how am I going to create this combination. When you're sparring, it's like a blank canvas and you can express yourself. And so I do think that in that way it's more similar to those, but they are kind of in a category that I would say is a little bit different. And that's the beautiful thing, is that different things are going to speak to different people, and maybe different combinations of different things are going to speak to different people. Someone might do art therapy on a Monday and, you know, trauma-informed kickboxing on a Wednesday, for example, and they really will complement each other really, really beautifully. And I think that's quite exemplified by some of the work from Kathy Van Ingen, who's a researcher in Canada, who runs a program called Shape Your Life, which is a trauma-informed boxing program. And one day they ripped up the canvas of the boxing ring and they had all of the participants, or they invited all of the participants to paint about their experiences with doing boxing after experiencing trauma. And then they collated all of that work and they created an art gallery, basically, where participants wrote a little bit about why they painted what they painted. And that's also been published as a research paper, which is a really beautiful read. So they all kind of work together, I think, and that's why we call them adjunctive therapies as well too. I think it's really important to note that nobody's saying, or I'm not saying, that martial arts take the place of therapy. There are some like keyboard warriors who get a little bit angry at me saying, you know, like people need therapy and that people need medication and da da da. I don't think everybody needs medication. I don't subscribe to the chemical imbalances needing to be rebalanced theory. I think that's bullshit. I think it's not trauma informed. But 100%, some people will. Some people need therapy at the same time. Some people won't. And that's the individualized approach that we need to be able to take. And the main part of that is asking people, what is going to heal you? And then honoring that by giving them access to the thing that they feel like they need.
Mm. It's like giving, well, it's giving space. But, and I think we've culturally, again, going back to patriarchy and everything, giving space isn't something that women tend to stereotypically have access to, so I feel like anyone would benefit from being in that space as well. Starting from with a coach,
definitely
a coach with no knowledge and not knowing any of this. I mean, obviously they could do your course, but is there any other pathway that a coach could go through to start this journey of becoming more trauma informed?
Yeah, so on my website, there's a free webinar which talks about, you know, what trauma is. and a little bit about grounding and why I don't use breath work. So it goes into what we've spoken about on this podcast in a little bit more detail. But I really feel like the foundations, the starting point would be to read The Body Keeps the Score. You will have a really good understanding of what trauma is if you read that book. So knowing what trauma is, then knowing 1 to 3 grounding strategies and, you know, just kind of sticking with that. You can learn so many. I have quite a lot in my toolkit now, but it's just like learning, you know, jiu-jitsu. You don't want to learn 20 moves all at once. You want to learn a few moves and then practice them, because that's actually going to stick and you'll actually be able to use them when you're rolling or competing. Mm-hmm. So learn 1 to 3 grounding strategies. Think about what's inherently therapeutic about your martial art. And so again, that webinar has a bit more of some of the research that I found, but think about it for yourself. What is inherently already really good that you can kind of accentuate, that you can emphasize? You know, is it the community? And therefore, which is common, right? So then think about your gym. Do you have a strong community? Do you have a women's only team? And this is the other thing that we highly recommend, is that all clubs have a women's only class as an option, but also, you know, integration is encouraged and there are women in leadership positions. So if you don't have a female coach, get one. Those are really easy, actionable things to have a more inclusive space, which is in of itself going to be more trauma informed. And then you can start to think about, all right, I know what trauma is. I know some grounding strategies. I feel like we have a really inclusive kind of space. Then if you wanted to start a trauma informed program, yeah, if you weren't going to do my course, it depends on your martial arts. So you could try and find if there's somebody who you can shadow, who is, or you can speak to, who's in your chosen martial art. And there are trauma-informed Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, there's trauma-informed boxing, there's trauma-informed kickboxing. There's a trauma-informed program for literally every martial art now, which is absolutely incredible. You could start to learn from. But I think opening up your awareness for what is trauma and what are grounding strategies, and then applying that in class and starting to notice when students are dysregulated. And especially one like really easy thing to do for everybody, whether you're a coach or not, is to notice when your training partners hold their breath. It's really powerful. I think if some people have started noticing when they are holding their own breath. But if you can put your awareness out and notice when your training partner is holding their breath, good thing is they're likely thing is that they are starting to feel overwhelmed and they're getting towards the outside of their window of tolerance. And so, you know, you can check in with them and say, hey, you okay? Mm-hmm. You feeling all right? As you're rolling. And you don't need to say, hey, breathe. Because if you say, hey, you okay? You feeling all right? Most people will breathe. If you say that, they'll stop and they'll go, oh, am I? I guess I was kind of like tensing up or something like that. You don't need to tell them, hey, you're tensing up. Yeah. They'll probably work that out for themselves. So that's a really great way to practice having an awareness of what's going on for other people's nervous systems too.
Wow. So informative. And these leads us to the last question of our podcast. We ask everyone this question, and you could perceive it the way that you want it. So you can either go very general or specific. So what are you fighting for?
Yeah, I love this question. And I think these days I am fighting to end violence. So if we think about the difference between fighting and violence, it's consent, right? It's engaging within combat that we accept, or it's having violence in our lives, which is being treated in a way that we do not accept. And I really feel like by showing up, by being a female role model to other women, by role modeling to men what strong women look like and helping them have more self-awareness in my personal training, but especially with the women that I work with, I'm fighting to break the cycle of violence, which means that by them taking action to heal their trauma, they're not going to pass that trauma on to their sons, who are not then going to become, you know, abusive in further relationships. And in that way, we can start to chip away at the domestic violence problem of the world, which is obviously incredibly huge and impacts about 1 in 3 women. So I'm fighting to end violence.
That's a big one. Thank you so much for... I feel like me and Marina have had a massive education about trauma.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Women Who Fight podcast. And credit to Will Grant for being our songwriter and sound editor. Please subscribe and share and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at womenwhofight.co.uk and check out our website for more content.